one is.
Can you hear me? Hey. Hey, Lionel, thank you for that high energy space saxophone hard rock. Thank you very much. And we're going to give you some energy too. And I just want to say, like, I am so thrilled to be here with Philippe Mogan, who is he's a true veteran of many scenes, but, you know, before punk. And he and I are going to, you know, come tell you from the point of view of music, the music, and how we lived the scene a little before punk and how we got into the punk. Philippe was born in Paris and did some photography, did projects with the open market, was published in Rock and Folk, and he'll tell us a little bit later about his the beginnings of the fanzine, his fanzine, I Want to Be Your Dog. And then he moved in 1970 to New York. And that's where he found his scene and the music business, and he did many, many things after that. Myself, I was born in Detroit. I was raised on the music, the great music that was happening in Detroit. It was on the radio. I couldn't go to some of the concerts because I was younger, as someone earlier said today. And but I was raised on that music, so it was just really a part of me. And so what we have in common is the Stooges in different ways. So, and the MC5. By the way, in the late 60s, that music, which is now called proto-punk, pre-punk, the influence, the godfathers of punk, etc., that was called hard rock music, specific to Detroit. But it's okay because now we put things in perspective. One word from you, if you like, before I play.
No, I just wanted to add exactly, I don't know if I can, yeah, okay. I just wanted to add exactly what you just said, that in fact when in 70 I met Patti Smith, I didn't even know, nobody knew that it was punk music. I mean, nobody said it was punk music. I mean, it was the term, I think you know better than me, came out, 75?
When the Sex Pistols started. Yeah, it was imported back, and that's what got us all excited again, because the music that inspired us was being played again.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, of course, my biggest work was to work with the Stooges. And so when I moved to New York, I had only one thing in mind, was to meet three people, Bob Dylan, Stooges, MC5. I was lucky because I went beyond my dreams and my search. And the thing that motivated me was that back then, rock and roll was totally forbidden in France. You have to know that. In other words, we didn't know anything about rock and roll. There was the concerts that were never published. And a few people knew by example that at L'Olympia, which was a big music hall, there was, you have to realize, there was 1 month of one artist, French artist, like Dalida, like whoever it was, I mean, people that I didn't even want to hear about or see. But we found out that on Mondays, it was the relâche. So it was the artist was not playing. And that was the night, when all the American artists would stop, like James Brown, Otis Redding, Janis Joplin, and Jimi Hendrix. I was lucky as a little kid, a school kid, to see Jimi Hendrix twice, 66 and 67. I can't say anything more than it's heaven. I mean, I was so lucky to hear that music. And so I had only one idea, is to go and find those people. Now, you talked about the open market. Open market was a very good friend of mine. We started in 62, 63, La Bande du Drugstore, Les Blousons Dorés. And we were all three pieces suits, and we brought the mod, the fashion in England over to the mods. They became the mods. And after that, I'm sorry, I'm taking so much time out of you.
We're going to talk about some of the stuff you did after we play your film. How's that?
Yeah. But just to get to there, mm-hmm. What we did, since there was no rock and roll in France, I took a local in Rue des Halles before it was destroyed in 1969, au 12 Rue des Halles, where I had my photo studio, and effectively I made the basement at the place for French musicians to come and play. Well, that cost a lot of money because that was the vegetable fruit place. And then they were destroying all the island on this side, but we were protected on that side. So in order to do that, I had to drive a cab during the weekends to make money to pay to get the nudity out that was there because of the fruits and vegetables, I mean, and so forth. I'm telling you this story just to get to the point. I had that taxi, which I would borrow, and with my friend Mark, who was back then from 63 at the Bande du Drugstore, we would drive to Amsterdam and bring back the records. But you got to understand, there was no Schengen or whatever the hell that is. There was borders, real borders, with custom people, with police and everything. So we had to go through all kind of little ways to get through to back to Paris. And I've heard lately, when Mark died, that some people complain that there weren't that many records in the store. Well, I'm sorry, the trunk of my car was not big enough. So, you know, we had what we had. And Mark was a special guy, I must say. Rip in peace. And the only reward I had is I could pick up a few albums and pay it half price. So even though I drove back and forth, and, you know, he paid for the gas. So that's another thing. And I, out of nowhere, I picked up in 1970 three albums. 69 Stooges, 70 Stooges, MC5. Those were the three albums. I have no idea how. Well, Fun House in 1970, I picked it up first because I loved the photos.
And
the spray.
We discovered, we didn't know this, apparently those must have been Amsterdam releases because it was called 69
and 70.
And 70, and of course that's the Stooges and Funhouse.
Exactly, exactly. And the MC5 was MC5.
And the MC5 was MC5?
Yeah.
Kick out the jams.
Motherfuckers, yeah. You know, if you want to be part of the problem, if you want to be part of the solution. Well, I wanted to be part of the solution, and always did it. And my main focus was to bring, since rock and roll was forbidden, to bring rock and roll to the kids. So all my life, all I did, I can call myself the beatnik rock, because all I did was go to get, you know, to places where I could meet interesting things, which brought us to New York in 1970, where I met Patti Smith, who took me around. How did I meet her? It's a long story. Yeah. But she introduced me to one of her lovers, who was Tom Verlaine from television. And another guy I was hanging out with when we had like press release for record companies was Danny Fields. He was the only guy out of the whole crowd of reporters and photographers and who, to me, felt like the right guy. And one day he told me, he said, "Hey, you got to come. I've got a great band. It's called The Ramones." And I said, well, yeah, why not? Let's go, you know. So this is how it went. Finally, in 73, my dream was the Stooges, so I moved to L.A., from New York to L.A., and where I spent months looking for the Stooges. What you got to realize, in 1973, there was the release of the third album of the Stooges, which was called Raw Power. The Raw Power, which was signed on CBS label because Elektra had dropped them off because they didn't sell any album. The Raw Power album did worse. By the way, it's double platinum now. I mean, 40 years or whatever later. And I finally took pictures of Iggy. You're going to see them there, I guess. And I befriended them, although Iggy was in a very, very, very bad stage. But James Williamson, who was the guitar, acted like the majordome, you know, like the guy who would open and find out who you are, what you want to do, who, you know, and so forth. And so finally, we befriended each other, and he, as a matter of fact, gave me a copy of Hunter Thompson, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, and he said, "Hey, this is your life." Okay, fine. Finally, one day, Iggy came out of this room where he never left, and I took him up to do the pictures you're going to see. Then, that was in 73. They were released in France in 74. That was enormous success, and Iggy Pop became very, very famous, and I never heard of him later. But I continue with James. And James one day came over and told me on my birthday, as a matter of fact, and Fatty said, "Hey, do you want to play those songs?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, they're just outtakes of Raw Power that we didn't use." And I listened to I Got a Right and Give Me Some Skin. And then my whole world changed. Because I realized, you're going to realize, Raw Power was remixed by David Bowie. What I released was the original recording untouched by David Bowie. Thank God. And this is, I don't know if you can play it now. Or
yeah, let's play this. Also, this is where Philippe told me that suddenly he became a record producer because Williamson asked him to do it. So he founded this label, Siamese Records,
which became Siamese Dogs in 2000.
Yeah. So here we go. I Got a Right, recorded in 74 and released.
Before 73.
Oh, before 73, excuse me.
The Trident Studios in London while they were doing.
Yeah, pardon. Oh. And then it was finally released in 77, which was when I heard it for the first time.
We'll be right back.
thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
Anyway, that's it.
Yeah.
And now I'm back, and I hope I can give some more, do some more things. By the way, like you said, I became a record producer. I got to tell you, I never, when I was in school, music, I didn't go to the class. I was more after girls. So I missed a lot of classes. I wasn't a musician, but there's the thing is, when we released and started the Siamese Records, James Williamson took off, and he went to learn to a school in Panama City, which is far away from L.A. I didn't see him for a couple of years. He called me back to do the New Values album, and which was nice of him to remember that I existed. And so I find myself in front of a wall. And there's something you got to realize is that sometimes when there's no more possibility, even though you're not made to do it, you find yourself with new aptitudes. And what I found out is I had an excellent, and still good, ear. And that helped me out to be able to go to the studios and record and be able to tell a guitar player who thought that he was doing well that he just made a mistake. The guy would get, you know, really cranky and say, oh, no, and then, well, come back, listen to it. And then, of course, it was, oh, okay. Anyway, I signed two marvelous bands, which I over here to tell about them. One is the Controllers. I think it's the best punk band of LA, circa 77, way after the British invasion. And by the way, the Neutron Bomb is the song they wrote that was taken away from them, you know, but by then there were so many rip-offs that it was unbelievable. Anyway, and the second one was the Weasels. And the Weasels, we put out a song called Bitter Her with a Rake, which of course was a spoof. But the Now movement, the feminist movement, took it so bad that they went in all the stores and broke the singles. What we meant to do then was to open a dialogue. There was a story of a young guy who was beating up his girlfriend because he caught her doing things with one of his best friends. And in fact, instead of having a dialogue, all we got as an answer is breaking the record. There was one woman on KROQ radio, very famous since, called Dusty Street. And she played it like, you know, and with comments I can't even say here. I just went, oh, wow, what he's saying. So anyway, so this is just to say that I always try to bring political as well as, you know, I mean, awareness to the kids mainly, because that's all I'm interested in. I knew the other guys, older and everything, they were gone. So why discuss with them? It was better to reach the new generation. And it's been my goal. And I never made any money. I spent a fortune. Iggy hates me because I got to write is the biggest bootleg records, punk records, ever done. So he thought that I made, excuse me, expression, a shitload of money. I didn't even recoup the cost of the single. But that's the thing, you know. When you see that your photo,
yeah,
or your record or whatever, your art is being spread all over the world, you imagine that you're getting a lot of money. You know, I got a lot of answer. The check is in the mail. I mean, that was from Tower Records. That was from Sam Good, Good is in New York. They all loved it. As a matter of fact, in 77, when the Ramones came, which I knew them from New York, came to do that show in L.A., Joe Ramones told me, he said, wow, man, this record energized the punk scene, the rock punk scene. So that was the biggest compliment I could get.
That was I Got It Right.
Yeah, that was I Got It Right. So.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think I spoke too much.
Well, I just want to say a couple of things about that we found on the internet. So, I Want to Be Your Dog fanzine was founded by Philippe Mogan, co-founder of Los Angeles record label Siamese Records in the 1970s. I Want to Be Your Dog fanzine. It was published in both France and the United States. And voila. And
as well as Harry Cover, by the way, which I started with a guy.
Yeah.
And... I had the bands playing in the basement. That's true.
And he in fact, basically, I mean, Philippe was the photo editor, but really the creative director and the provider of all the content because it was his photos. So that was interesting. And then we saw on the screen the yellow record cover called Godfathers of LA Punk. What year was that released?
That was in 2000. That's when I decided to go back again in the business. Unfortunately, in 2005, the CD died. So
Well, I'm going to get one off of Discogs or wherever I can get it. So, and here, you know, it's a compilation of Siamese Records, punk rock bands, today called Siamese Dogs Records, a label set up by Philippe Mogan. He first set out to the States in 71 to track down the Stooges, found them, took pictures of them, a few exclusive ones in the inlay, and released I Got a Right on the Siamese label with then Stooges guitarist James Williamson as VP. This kicks off the pre-street punk party, and along the way, you'll get the original Neutron Bomb by the Controllers, a track that inspired the Weirdos, Black Sabbath, and Doors Fanatics. The Weasels toured for a few years in Southern California, with Van Halen opening up for them, pre-spandex. They contribute Beat Her with a Rake, a song about, you guessed it, women beating. Although the general public decided to storm record shops to destroy the record, it was nevertheless deemed a classic and was played the shit out of on KROQ. The Attitude contributed Hound Dog, yes, that one, with Little Richard playing on the piano. Deemed too blasphemous at the time, it didn't get any airplay at all, and the band ended up killing each other whilst trying to record an album. Max Laser was probably one of the What You Get Here is an excellent insight into some of the best bands L.A. had to offer.
Thank you.
So, yes, it was mentioned that I Got It Right stimulated the scene. And me in Detroit, okay, exit. Right. Me in Detroit, I was...
a little girl.
Yeah. Like I said, I grew up with the music. And you know, I knew about the punk music. I knew about Talking Heads. I had the albums and everything. And I got that single, I Got It Right, the original one, which Philippe tells me is worth a lot of money. Got to look that up, but I'm not giving it away. And in any case, that I would play in my dark room while I was making my photos, and I do have to say that it was more high energy than the Raw Power. Like you say, the mix probably had a lot to do with it.
Yeah.
And that really, for me, that woke me back up to the punk, you know, and to what was being then called punk. And I said, like, this is it. So now I'm going to play you. What I did was I got pulled into rock and roll. I lived in France back and forth. I went to school at University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, which, of course, is where the Stooges live and a lot of other people. And
NBC 5, Mitch Ryder.
They were in Detroit. Well, they were there by that time, by 77. But I was there back and forth. But when I would come to France on summer vacations and Christmas to, you know, to visit my parents and the rest of my family who lived here, you know, I was trying to find rock and roll. Like, there wasn't any, of course. And I did get a Wanna Be Your Dog fanzine. And what I would see when I, you know, share records with people I met, guys I met, they would all be going, Ron Ashton, like he was a god or something. So just to be brief, I just felt right at home. Like, I never thought of, you know, saying Ron Ashton's name like a god, but of course these were people who I liked. So I go back to the U.S. I graduate from art school, and just before I graduated in 77, I walked into a party that the Destroy All Monsters Art Collective was giving, and the Niagara and Carrie Lauren, who were in the original art collective of Destroy All Monsters, were going to be putting together a band with noise music and space music, like Space Sax, Elena, Where Are You, and Space Guitar. And they asked Ron Ashton to join. He came to see them play, and he joined. He kind of thought Niagara was like worth his looking into. And
that's why after the New Order. No, it's okay. Yeah. It's okay.
Well, you saw that he produced the New Order album. That was what Ron was doing before. But Ron was back home. Scott was back home in 77. And Ron convinced Michael Davis of the MC5 to come and play with these young people, you know, in Destroy All Monsters. It was avant-garde at first. And, you got Ron Ashton's guitar and Michael's bass, you know, and a very good drummer who is not generally well known. And so then they would practice every day. I was just part of their, you know, their friends. I had my camera with me all the time. I was a fine art student, and photography was my choice. And I didn't quite realize what was happening to me with the photography. But they would practice every afternoon in somebody's basement, getting ready to play their first show out. And every night we would party at somebody's house. And suddenly, Ron Ashton and Scott Ashton are like my close personal friends. And so it was kind of funny to think back on all of that. You know, later in the Detroit burgeoning early punk scene, right after that, 77, 78, everybody just came and, come on. Anyway, it was fun. It was our life. I'm going to play you now a compilation of my slideshows, my photos from 77, 78, which is when it was really, you know, happening in Detroit, Ann Arbor. And the song that's going to go with it has only just been published in 2018. It was a jam that we did on Halloween 77 with a fellow named Roger Clark Miller, who later went on to form Mission of Burma, the post-punk band in Boston. It was just a jam. I said, I'm going to play drums, you know, like, can I play drums? No, it was just a mess, and just for fun. And so Roger, like, sent me a tape in early 77. He came back and he said, I'm going to put your voice down, you know, will you do that? And he sent me a tape that is this, and it blew me away. And all these years he's been trying to get it released, and so it was released on Hozak Records of Chicago. And I'll just read about the music there. Roger's calling it FUK, Fucked Up Kids. Band members for that jam included Andrew Nauman, Carrie Lauren, Martin Swope, bass, Sue Rinsky, vocal, Roger Miller, guitar, vocal. They played only one gig, Halloween 1977, at The Cube. That was the Destroy All Monsters home, Ann Arbor, Michigan. Roadkill was written for that one performance. Sue had a lyric, and Roger came up with the music. It was a totally fun, sloppy mess. There was more than a slight connection to Destroy All Monsters equals D-A-M, you know, like F-U-K. Miller had played drums and bass for that earlier DAM briefly in 1977, but declined to become a full-time member. His brothers Lawrence and Benjamin continued playing in the band. These are conservatory-trained musicians who were doing noise music and stuff ahead of the time. Rinsky was part of the DAM. Ann Arbor Inner Circle. Fuck member Carrie Lauren was a founding member of DAM. And Fuck member Martin Swope later joined Miller in Mission of Burma. So music is all Roger. He did it himself and played it himself. And here we go.
I just want to add also what you have to understand is hard nowadays, but there was no smartphone, no internet, nothing at all, not even the press. I mean, besides us, you know, New Wave and punk fanzines. I don't know how the damn sound went all over the world. I mean, going from Detroit to New York, to New York to London, London, Paris, back again to L.A. I mean, you know, it's pretty hard to imagine it in your days when all you got to do is press on a button and then you got the song popping out. And we didn't have all this. I don't know how we did it. I mean, it was amazing, but that's maybe what made it. It's the fact that it was more, and that's what I said, I was also very political, is that it was the youth movement. It was like a need for all the kids to express themselves in some ways, and they didn't have to talk to one another to come up with a sound that was totally, totally off the grid. Mm-hmm. Because the grid was, I remember when I left France, it was Yes, and a super tramp. I mean, the things like, like this, So when you heard sounds like that, for us, it was like a release. So, I understand where...
The Dead Boys also.
The Dead Boys, yeah. Of course.
But, that was, wow, okay, here we go, that's punk. Yeah. I mean, not that the British wasn't, but, whatever. And so I did want to say, Selena had mentioned about the playground and the trash ground. Well, my scene that you saw part of there in Detroit, nobody knew what we were doing. It was like here that bar that's in there was not really doing much business, and so alternative places, and they didn't mind. They sold a lot of beer, and they were nice. They were really cool, and so it was our playground. We had concerts every night of the week all over the place, including Sundays. We could go to 2-3 concerts a night, at different places. It really was our playground, and nobody knew. Just the mainstream didn't know a thing. And I do want to say that it was a pretty large amount of people. But now that I've discovered the real contemporary punk rock scene in France, I almost think that that's a bigger scene and more bands. But whatever. Mm. You saw in there White Noise magazine. That was the fanzine that some fellas put out. Actually, they came to get me. They came to cajole me. To give them photos. But it was cool. These are people, it was like we all appreciated each other. And they said, hey, we're starting this fanzine. It's called White Noise. And you're going to be the photo editor. That's where I got that term from earlier. And they said, look, all you got to do is give us some photos. You don't got to do the layout. You don't have to do anything. We'll do everything else. And here's your title, So that was fun. They're really good guys. We're all in touch. A lot of people from my scene are back in touch and doing things again since the White Stripes came out and woke us all up. And the other thing that I wanted to say is that if you want to find out more about this particular period of Detroit rock history, which is really, really not very publicized, but is getting more known now, there is a site called Detroit Punk Archive. And there's tons of stuff in there. I just found recordings of stuff I said. It was great. I'm like, oh! No, but it's really, really an amazing site. So... I guess, with that...
We conclude?
Any questions?
No?
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you for this amazing conversation. We can
thank
go
you.
Up and...
Okay, thank
and
you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.